Coming to you from Orange County, California, this is the Jug Life Podcast with Max Ada and Chad Wesley Smith.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to another episode live from Long Island, New York.
Come on, guys.
At Outlift Athletics, this is the Jug Life Podcast. I'm joined, as always, by mischievous Max Montana. I am Chad Wesley Smith. Today's episode is brought to you by Long Island Iced Teas and Squatting with Forward Knees. It's a lifestyle. Thank you for joining us. We just finished up a little squat workshop. Great big group here at a fantastic facility. Outlift Athletics, again, thank you for hosting. We're going to talk today about, you know, different exercises for the squat and what weak points they address, and particularly a little bit more in depth about assessing leg versus back strength and exercises to bring up this sort of imbalance, which essentially everyone will fall into one of these categories of strong legs, weak back, or weak legs, strong back. And being able to effectively solve that problem is going to make your squat training much more efficient and help you improve your weights that much faster. So before we get into all that, we're going to take a quick break, and our sponsor people are going to throw in some ads there, and we're going to do some trivia with you guys so you can win shirts and hats and whatnot. So we'll take a quick break.
Hiring? Every business needs great people, and a better way to find them. Something better than posting your job online and just praying for the right people to see it. ZipRecruiter knew there was a smarter way, so they built a platform that finds the right job candidates for you. ZipRecruiter learns what you're looking for, identifies people with the right experience, and invites them to apply to your job. In fact, 80% of employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site in just one day. The right candidates are out there. ZipRecruiter is how you find them. Right now, our listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/JugLife. That's ZipRecruiter.com/JugLife. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
All right, we are back with the Jug Life Podcast live from Long Island, New York. This is a good group.
This is better.
This is a good group.
Not like those pussies from Queens.
All right, so we're talking about different exercises to address different weak points, weak portions of the squat. So we'll start with the beginning, the setup, and I digress. We'll start with rounding over in the squat, which is fixed at the beginning of the squat with a great setup. So if you have problems getting pushed forward, getting rounded over, oftentimes people want, well, what exercise do I do to fix that? First thing you need to do, go back, fix your technique, tight setup, stuff we already went over today, hands closer, upper back, scaps retracted, elbows pulled together, elbows under the bar. If you're doing a good job with all those things and you're still getting rounded over in the squat, then we can talk about specific exercises for that. The two best things you can do are front squats and safety squat bar. Safety squat bar is really the only specialty bar that I'll advocate for the use of outside of some injury workaround type of stuff. Safety squat bar is gonna try and round you over, so you have to push back against it. And just kind of general upper back training, lat pull downs, pull ups, chin ups, rows, upright rows, shrugs. A thicker, more muscular upper back is gonna be harder to be pushed out of position. If you get stuck in the hole, you just go down the squat and you don't come up at all.
Too much weight.
Too much weight. The weight is probably too heavy. Very, very rarely do I see someone execute good technique and not move out of the hole at all. What is happening usually from a technical standpoint is what we talked about earlier, 135 like your max like 135, is someone gets... they unrack that max weight and they get the, oh shit, this is heavy, and a very slow descent, and they just have no rebound, no energy to drive them out of the hole at all. So if you're getting stuck at the very bottom, do a better job of picking your weights, or make sure that you're descending with some tempo getting a little rebound out of the hole. Now, the most common place that squats are getting missed, 2, 3, maybe 4 inches above parallel, you know, that's kind of depending on how tall you are. Your knees shift back, your hips rise before your shoulders, and this is where we're going to be able to better identify two different groups: stronger legs to weaker back, or weaker legs to stronger back. If you hit the hole, your knees shift back, your hips rise early, and you're able to fight against the weight for a decently long time, and sometimes good morning your way through that, you are probably in the stronger back group. If you hit the hole, are very, very fast for the first few inches, and then it's like you hit a wall and the lift just stops, you're probably in the stronger legs, weaker back group. Other things that we can look to as indicators here: if you have a very strong squat compared to your deadlift, stronger legs, weaker back. With the, and I'm talking, best comparison would be a high bar squat compared to a conventional deadlift. An exception to that might be if you could have a really strong back, but if you have really short arms, maybe you still don't have that high of a deadlift relative to your squat. But that's definitely going to be something to look to. If you have a very good squatting build, so short legs, longer torso, yeah, it's probably more likely that you're going to be in the strong legs, weak back group. I'd say Max has to be the farthest into the strong legs, weak back group. Is
well, yeah.
You had front squatted 250.
No, my best front squat was 507 before I could deadlift 507. I think I front squatted 507 and deadlifted maybe like 450 or something like that. Because my legs were just, it was all legs and no back. And I actually have long arms too. So it was just, you know, super weak back and really strong legs is going to be really hard to do any kind of conventional deadlift.
And that stemmed from obviously 30 front squats, 30 yeah. maximum front squats a week, and zero deadlifts.
Yes, I mean, zero deadlifts
yeah.
for years.
Yeah. So as we look at this, well, first we'll talk about the strong legs, weak back group. So both Max and I fall into this category. Again, this would be a higher squat relative to your deadlift. You might still have a stronger deadlift than your squat, but particularly if you're a newer lifter, maybe 1 or 2 years of lifting experience, 90% of the time, new lifters stronger deadlift than their squat. That doesn't necessarily mean that they're in the strong back, weak legs group. But if that relationship was quite a bit closer, like one of you I talked to, and he had the same squat and deadlift, but had only been lifting for a year and a half, that would probably be pretty indicative of strong legs, weak back. So what do you think we need to do to fix this problem? Build your back is a much more obvious answer than we suspected. So we need to do direct back training. My favorites for that are going to be the 45 degree back raise or back raise on a GHR is such a simple, effective exercise. You know, whether you're doing that holding weights across your chest or putting a bar on your back or even doing like a deadlift as you do the back raise, all of those really simple, really effective exercise. Good mornings, RDLs can be a good one. If you have access to the back attack machine, that's probably one of the best things that you can do. But very simple, straightforward answer. You know, a simple answer doesn't mean that it's necessarily an easy fix, because you're going to have to do a lot of hard work on that. And then any conventional deadlifting variations, those are going to address your back strength. Now, the bigger group is the strong back to weak legs. What do we like for that?
For strong back, weak legs, you obviously have to do things that isolate your legs. So the sort of the go-to thing for a lot of people, depending on your qualification, if you're on the newer side, belt squats. When you do belt squats, having the belt around your hips basically allows you to train the legs in absence of the back. So now you no longer have any pressure on the back. The bar is not supported by your torso. So you can't do anything. You can't do the, you know, good morning squat and take pressure off your legs to execute the lift. So you have to train your legs when you do belt squats. In addition to that, as you get more proficient at belt squats, they start to become, your legs start to become a little stronger.
Make sure in the belt squats too, when he said the belt's got to be low on your hips.
Yeah.
It needs to hang kind of off your butt, not be up
on your low back and pull you forward. You want to be able to stay very upright when you're doing it.
Right.
And really emphasize breaking at the knee, pushing your knees forward during the exercise.
And that actually goes for all the exercises. So if you're training, if you got weak back, weak legs, if you're doing stiff leg deadlifts to build your back up, make sure that when you're doing those exercises, you're using the right technique, right? That you're actually emphasizing the use of your back over just the load on the bar. You're trying to lift as much as possible, and maybe you bend your knees a little bit or you don't use complete range of motion. It's not gonna pay off if you don't actually execute the lift in a way that really isolates and kind of transfers to the classic lift, right? You do stiff leg deadlifts, do them strict, use your back. You do belt squats, do them like you want to squat, keep your knee forward, use your quads more. As your legs get stronger, as belt squats kind of takes off, then the next couple exercises would definitely be like front squats and high bar squats. And then obviously there's other variations of things like different kinds of machines, power squats, leg press,
hack squats.
I would say probably hack squat is the top of those machines in terms of what I've used. I'm sure there may be different brands that feel better for different people, but hack squats are a little better because you can kind of position yourself more similar to a squat, I feel, and get your knees out over your feet more and kind of use your legs better. But those machines all kind of fall into the same category. They would be somewhere in between belt squats and or somewhere just under belt squats or right around the equal with belt squats. Not quite as good as like a front squat though.
But when you're trying to use front squats or high bar squats, which people would think of as like a quad dominant movement, you know, we're doing this in an effort to bring up the relative strength of our legs to be equal with our back. You can do a front squat or a high bar squat and the same thing happens. You hit the hole, your hips shoot back, and it turns into this kind of good morning type of move. Of course, in the front squat, you're having to fight to hold the weight in, but it still happens and people's chest drops. If you're gonna use that exercise to build up your legs relative to your back, you need to really be strict in your technique, pushing the knees forward, keeping a vertical torso. You know, don't go to a weight that forces you to break that technique and turn it into a more back dominant exercise. So be strict in the technique with that. The last thing about this point would be technical cues to help you out. You know, both of these groups need to focus on keeping their knee forward out of the hole. Of course, the strong legs group wants to keep that big toe pressure and knee forward so they can most effectively use their quads. And then the strong back group needs to think about that to avoid their hips shifting back right away and their back wanting to take over in the lift. Now the strong legs, weak back group, because they have a weaker back, the cue that I talked about of pushing your upper back into the bar, trying to throw the bar off with your upper back, that's something you really need to emphasize. Because if you don't do that, since your back is not very strong, you're gonna lose the angle right away. Your legs are gonna push hard, your hips are gonna rise, you'll lose the angle, the lift is over. So you need to use all the back strength that you have. You know, the strong back group doesn't really need to emphasize pushing with their back that much because you already want to do that. A couple other exercises you can use to improve right out of the hole, right, you know, 2-3 inches out of the hole, that sticking point. And this would be for people who are more so in a balanced position between leg and back strength. Pause squats are definitely a good one. You know, you can pause at any point during the lift, whether that's in the hole, you pause on the way down, on the way up. If you have a sticking point, let's say you miss squats 3 inches above parallel. 3 inches above parallel isn't where you need to get stronger because the bar has to slow down before it stops. So we need to get stronger in the area where you're slowing down. So if you're missing lifts at 3 inches above parallel, I'd try pausing at 1.5 to 2 inches above parallel. You can pause right out of the hole. Getting stronger, more powerful at the initial part of any of the lifts, squat, bench, or deadlift. So faster out of the hole in the squat, more powerful off the chest in the bench press, and stronger off the floor in the deadlift. That's gonna carry good momentum through the rest of the lift and help you through any subsequent sticking point. But when you're doing a pause squat, there's kind of two ways to do it. You could squat to the end of your range of motion and sort of sit your hamstrings on your calves and, you know, relax more or less in the hole, which I'd call a passive pause squat. Or you could do an active pause squat where you're gonna go to about maybe half an inch short of the end range of motion, where you actually have to actively hold yourself in that position. The active pause squat probably gonna have a bit higher carryover to your squat than a more passive pause. Last one that I like there is a dead squat or Anderson squat. So out of the power rack, you'd set the pins at, the pins or the spotting straps at an inch below your sticking point. You get under the bar and stand up from there, so it totally eliminates the stretch reflex. That one can be a good exercise. Only problem I see people running into with that is it often turns into too much of a different movement. A lot of people can kind of do a good morning out of there. They start with a more bent, leaned forward position. Just because it's hard to get, especially if you're less mobile, it's hard to get under the bar without the load of the bar pushing you down. Take videos of your regular squat, take videos of the dead squat, make sure that the positions are pretty comparable in that low range of motion, but those can both be good exercises. The dead squat's just gonna be done for a single, multiple singles. Usually start out in the first block. If you wanted to use it in a hypertrophy block, even though it's not that appropriate of an exercise for it, but you still could do it if you really struggle with this area. We'd build up the number of singles from week to week. So maybe week one would be 6 to 8 singles, week two, 8 to 10, week three, 10 to 12. And on a fixed rest period, it's pretty short rest because it's only one rep. So maybe 20, 30 seconds rest between reps. And then after that, you could work on increasing the weight through strength, through the strength phase while you cut down the number of sets, and then peaking, maybe you cut it out entirely, or you're just doing 3 to 5 singles on it pretty heavy. The last part of exercise selection for the squat that we'll talk about is the concept of mechanical overload. So if you're familiar with scientific principles of strength training, we talk about the principle of overload, and that's the training must be significant or stimulating enough to drive adaptation, and it must get harder over time. So mechanical overload is a different concept, but people will talk about overloading exercises a lot of times when they're talking about this stuff. That's maybe a misuse of the term, at least by the way that we define it. So mechanical overload are exercises that allow you to use more weight than you'd be able to in the regular competition exercise. So for the squat, that's going to be squatting from high pins or maybe to a high box. Be reverse band squats, or the one that I use and program the most is a walkout and hold. And these exercises are as much psychological as they are physiological. They're going to help you feel more confident with a heavier weight. Because the weights are very heavy, they're going to generate a ton of neural fatigue. And that neural fatigue is going to take the longest to decay. So you need to put it far enough away from a meet so you can actually, you don't mess up your taper with it. High pin squat, high box squat, those are both fine. So the high pin squat would just be setting the pins. So maybe you just do a quarter squat down to them and stand up so you can feel the weight. You're not gonna get stronger necessarily from doing that and through a full range of motion powerlifting squat, but it is gonna let you feel a heavy weight. If you struggle with the psychology of putting max squats on your back, that could be helpful. High box will achieve the same thing. Reverse band squat, you get to go through the full range of motion. The bands assist you out of the hole. Definitely some benefit to that. With any of these exercises, the risk of using them is this high fatigue being generated. And where people are gonna run into that problem more and more is that they try and put excessively heavy weights on. So I'd say 110 to 120% of your one rep max would be an appropriate weight for you to use in a mechanical overload exercise. The stronger you are, the lower on the percentage you'll be. The weaker you are, the higher on the percentage. We have someone who squats 200 pounds, doing a 220 pound pin squat or walkout and hold isn't gonna give them that oh shit feeling of this weight that they've never touched, because it's just not that significant. So they could go maybe up to 240, but if I tried to do a 20% overload on a 970 or 1,000 pound squat and put 1,200 on, I would be fucked for 3 weeks with that. So the stronger you get, smaller overload would be okay. And I know it might be cool to put the blue bands hanging from the top of this rack and you can put 150% of your max on and post it on Instagram, and you got like so many likes, and oh my God, bro, you're such a beast. But when your knees hurt, your back hurts, your soul hurts for the next, you know, the next 2 weeks, and the rest of your training goes to shit, will it have been worth it? Of course it is. Look how many likes you got. Of course it was worth it. So with that, understand that training doesn't happen in a vacuum. What you do today affects tomorrow, affects the next day. So even though, you know, pushing a little bit harder on one of the lifts could be worth it, but understand if you have this really hard squat day on Monday, maybe you have to back off your bench work a little bit on Tuesday or deadlift on Wednesday or however you set your training up. Just keep in mind that you can't go absolute balls to the wall every lift, every day, because they're going to begin to interfere with each other. So the walkout and hold is the one that I prescribe the most, and it is exactly what it sounds like. Put 110 to 120% of your max on, unrack, walk it out, hold it. I know we're here in the Northeast, a lot of you may compete in the RPS with a monolift, so that might just be an unrack and hold if you like to cheat, you know. But yeah, same idea, you know, unrack, hold it, breathe like you're about to begin the squat. So you're brace, hold that 4 or 5 seconds like that, breathe again, brace again, you know, a couple of rounds like that. Usually one walkout and hold is all I will prescribe for an entire training cycle. And it's going to be somewhere between 10 and 21 days out from the meet. Stronger you are, the farther out it is from the meet. The weight's very heavy. A lot of neural fatigue being generated from that. So you need time that's slower to decay. So you need more time for that to decay. It's not something you need to do all the time. One set, maybe you do one during strength and one during peaking. And that's probably going to be sufficient for you. So those are the exercises, you know, the main exercise we're using to address these different problems in the squat. We're going to take another quick break. When we come back, we'll take Q&A from all these fine people. All right, we are back, Jug Life Live from Outlift Athletics in Long Island, New York.
Yeah, that was a good one. Yeah. That's the best of all of them
they
so
are,
far.
They're very good.
I say that every time.
So questions, you've got questions, we might have answers. Any questions about what we've covered today in the squat or any other training stuff?
Questions on like accommodating resistance, like bands and like chains and all that stuff. I've seen you talk about it,
Yeah, so as an exercise variation, they're not a terrible thing. As in every week in your training, they're probably not the best use of your time. Most raw lifters are going to be missing lifts in the areas we talked about, right in the hole, first 2, 3, 4 inches out of the hole. If you're using bands and chains, the lift is the least challenging in that range of motion. If you're wearing a squat suit, the squat suit provides the most assistance in the lower part of things. You know, the 2, 3, 4 inches above parallel is probably the deepest that most of those guys squat. Anyways, but so you're not getting the hard work where you need more hard work. So it's kind of flipped the stuff that's going to be more beneficial to the raw lifter. Pause squats, squats from the low pins, a dead squat, where it makes the lift more challenging in that portion of things. This is very, very rare to see a raw lifter miss in the, you know, 2, 3, 4 inches from the top.
So something else to think about too is that establishing good technique and solidifying technique is a matter of repeating something that, for one, is going to transfer to the actual lift. And like for the reasons he said, that's probably going to have a lower transference to the actual squat. But at the same time, repeating that exercise more and more times. So if you have a whole training cycle where you do, let's just say, 1,000 reps of squats, but 50% of them were done with a rubber band on the bar, now you have half of your technique is different than what it should be with maximum weights. Does it make sense?
Especially the band can create almost like a Smith machine type of effect, where it's very hard to deviate forward and backwards, where without that, you know, a lifter may have a problem with the bar shifting forward in their foot, too far back in their foot, and it's going to kind of mitigate that as a problem, and in doing so not allow you to address that issue.
Yeah.
Other questions?
So I guess this would be more catering towards coaching than working yourselves. If you were working with a new client or for squatting, at what point would you say you would want to transfer over from just working that lift to using some of the assistance exercises we were talking about before? Do you have certain landmarks, as in like once they get 2 times body weight, or is it just once they plateau that you would start thinking about it, or would you do it right away?
So yeah, early in the lift, if I have an article called The Pyramid of Strength, and it kind of touches on this idea that early in a lifter's career, with very low qualification, there's a very broad number of exercises that can help them improve. You know, if you think back to your first week of lifting, your first week of squatting, first month of squatting, you were truly in that beginner gains phase. You could squat, you could leg press, leg extension, hack squat, you know, lunge, goblet squat, whatever, and all of those things would make your squat go up. Just because you can get benefit from a wide number of exercises, though, doesn't mean you necessarily should. What we should do is create a well-rounded base of fitness, so some variation can be used right off the bat. But if you're changing exercises every week or giving them too many exercises, they're not going to be able to work on their technique at all. So what I would do is probably permanently keep the high bar squat or low bar squat in, and then choose one or two variations to use for a month at a time and make small adjustments from there. So you go for a month, maybe even 2 months with those first two variations, and then choose two new ones. But the variations don't need to be really broad. And again, we don't want to change them too often, because if this is really the problem with anyone who's changing exercises too frequently, is they're not able to develop enough skill in the exercise to actually create some real output in it. And this goes to the concept of directed adaptation, that if we want to get better at something, you have to train that thing, whatever it is. But if we change every week, new exercise, like, yeah, you might set PRs in it. Maybe you're made a PR because you never fucking done it before. Or maybe you made a PR because you haven't done it in 6 months and you don't know what in those 6 months actually contributed to making a PR there. So it's the two sides of this coin are directed adaptation and adaptive resistance. Adaptive resistance means that the longer you do one thing, the less benefit it's gonna give to you. But we have to do it long enough to develop the skill and get the directed benefit from it, but not so long that it starts yielding really low returns. See max front squatting 30 times a week for 13 years.
Yeah.
I mean, how fast did your squat go up at the start?
I went from 363 pound front squat to a 480 pound front squat in 6 weeks. And then from 484.
Yeah, don't just listen to that part. It's the next part that's more important.
From 484 to 507 was probably several years. Yeah. Maybe. Yeah. So basically, let's start squatting.
Yeah. So what you're saying is it went up 120 pounds in 6 weeks. That's my main
takeaway. So you're saying there's a chance.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that's perfect example. Directed adaptation to begin with.
Yeah.
Maximum front squatting gave him a huge benefit on his maximum front squat, and then ran into adaptive resistance where the gains came slower and slower and slower because of that. So yeah, some variation right off the bat, but give him enough time to practice that and actually develop some skill. And then as you kind of go through that process a couple different times, you'll begin to see the exercises that are more beneficial to them and the ones that maybe don't benefit them quite as much.
Some quick point to add to that. When you're assessing the difference between a beginner, somebody who does not have skill, and his like, you know, when you walk in the gym the first time you squat, what's stronger? What's stronger, your back or your legs? No one really knows, because it looks like, you know, you're just shaky and trying to figure it out. The difference between a beginner and an intermediate level lifter can be identified by the technique. A beginner will do a squat or do any movement and have different outcomes every time. The technique looks different every time.
Yeah, 10 reps, 10 mistakes.
Right.
10 different mistakes.
An intermediate lifter will do a lift 10 times and have the same mistake 10 times. So if you have weak legs and you're an intermediate lifter, you're going to fail squats and do the same movement over and over the same time every time. Does that make sense to you guys? So once you've developed the skill enough to do squatting, you're beyond that first couple months or 6 months, 8 months, whatever it is, of actually like, now I know how to squat, but now I have this one problem, which is always the same problem. You know you're in this intermediate phase, and that's when the more selective exercises play a bigger role in addressing specific technique issues, rather than just being general exercises that develop a broad range of fitness.
Other questions? Here, and then back there.
Would you say there's room for the low bar squat and super tool training?
Yeah, for sure. The way I try to teach people to squat, and I think Chad's very similar in that, the high bar squat is the sort of the foundation of learning how to squat, because it transfers well. It's a very good exercise. It's a very well-rounded exercise for developing leg strength and becoming stronger. It's also a little bit more intuitive. The difference between doing a high bar squat and a low bar squat for me is really a matter of just shifting the bar lower on our backs, okay? That makes some things happen. It kind of puts your chest down. You tip over a little more of a torso inclination, and you're going to use your hips and back a little bit differently. But the movement and everything that you're trying to do should be basically the same. So switching between techniques is fine. It may take a training cycle of, you know, practicing the skill of low bar squatting to sort of get the initial establishment of what it's supposed to be like and what it's supposed to feel like. But once you're beyond that point, low bar squatting is something we would do close to powerlifting meets or close to like a super total meet, not something we would do kind of far from that competition in the last or the, you know, first couple weeks, not in the hypertrophy phases, not in the strength phases, really only kind of as we get close to the competition.
I think that goes a lot to, as Max was saying, that we don't coach the high bar squat and the low bar squat. I don't think of them as two different exercises.
Right.
It's just a different place the bar is on your back when you're squatting. That necessitates some change in more forward torso angle, but we coach the lower body mechanics almost identically.
Yeah. The intent is the same.
Question right back there.
Yeah, so as opposed to doing 30 masses a week, what would be, I guess, a healthy amount of times in a year to undergo a peaking cycle and really feel out your max without taking away too much time away from your training?
Like 29 a week. I think you pushed it just too far.
That's good.
Yeah, it's gonna vary. So whether it's, if you're a competitive powerlifter, the only time that you're going to be taking true maximums, one rep maximum, should be in a meet. I'd say 2 to 4 times a year competing is a good number. The stronger you become, the more stressful each of those competitions, physically stressful those competitions are going to be, because the weights are that much heavier. I got a really big carryover throughout my career from training to competition. Before I squatted 970 in competition, my best training squat was 915. So you do 55 more pounds, that's like a pretty profound difference. So I've never understood these people who I see post videos the week after a meet, like hitting another PR. I was damn near in like a coma after meets, you know. Just wanted to take a nap for 1 week nap. So, but if you're newer to competition and the weights aren't as heavy, it's not going to be as stressful and as fatiguing. So you can compete a little bit more frequently, and it may be beneficial to compete a little bit more frequently as you develop the skill of competition and you feel more comfortable with that and are able to take that energy that you feel at a meet and make it work for you rather than against you. So I'd say a true one rep max, I mean, 4 to maybe 6 times, like a couple training maxes, but a training max still shouldn't be to the same level as a meet max with the adrenaline and peak.
Yeah, the one thing I would say too is like, take a step back, because the question itself is like, what does it matter how many times you need to do a max squat in a year, right? What's important is think about the long-term progression, long-term plan you have as an athlete. If you knew that you were going to increase your squat by 5% every training cycle, and let's say a training cycle is 12 weeks long, there's no real need to test to see how strong you are, right? You know that if I do this training, I get better, I'm gonna get stronger, it's gonna go up at the meet. And you add a few kilos to your squat every meet, and you do, you know, 4 meets a year or 3 to 4 meets a year, you're gonna have a huge squat in a few years, right? So I think a really important thing is to consider sustainability. If your system of training is sustainable and you make progress every time you go through training cycles, then, you know, it's like a savings account, right? You're putting money in the bank. It's gonna be there because your training is consistent and sustainable. You're not going so hard for some short period of time that I made like 3 extra PRs this cycle. The next cycle, I couldn't do that because I was fucked up from the last one. So I didn't make any progress, but then this next one I can push really hard. You know, it's like you're just going back and forth. You're fighting yourself. Just think about it as a long-term sustainable plan too. It's not important how often or how hard you can do it. It's what's important is that you make progress on a regular basis. I know Chad made progress for several years where like every training cycle you did, not only did you improve your total, at least, you know, not say every time at the meet, but you also gained a certain amount of body weight. There was just a consistency.
Well, that part wasn't on purpose.
But. Yeah. Well, but there's a consistency to every training cycle where Marissa's.
It was consistently 5 kilos a meet, which was impressive, body weight.
The Caprese burger was. Oh, yeah. There's this place down by Chad's house that serves a burger that is a burger, and on top of that is another size of a piece of fried cheese, the size of the burger. It's amazing.
There's a tomato on top of that, so yeah, vegetables.
So you got vegetables. It's basically a salad. If you look at like Marissa is a great example where there's just lots of consistent, sustainable progress, right? No one training cycle is the best ever. No one training cycle is, you know, breaking her back anytime. It's just consistent, steady progress. So.
Yeah. So what you're going to probably look at more during the regular training cycle is rep maxes, yeah, and training PRs. I'd say beginners can do that a little bit more frequently. We'll often write programs that are like a 3 up, 1 down. So 3 weeks of hard training and then a deload. And all 3 of those weeks, 8 rep max, 8 rep max, 8 rep max. There's some strategy to the weight selection there. Very unlikely that week 1 is a PR. Possible that for very beginner lifters, week 2 might be a 5-pound PR, and week 3 is a 15-pound PR. But more likely that the third week is setting them up for a PR there. So they might make 3 PRs in a 12-week training cycle in each lift. A bit more advanced lifters could go as frequently as that. They'll usually only have 2 rep maxes. Like what I have Walker do a lot of times is he'll have a light, medium, heavy squat and then light, medium, heavy. So the heavy ones, the first heavy one would be 10 to 15 pounds below his PR, and then the second heavy one would be 5 to 10 pounds above his existing PR. And that's going along with principle of overload, training must get harder over time. So if you made 1 squat PR a month, like for every training cycle, whether, you know, 8 rep PR, 5 rep PR, 3 rep PR, 1 rep PR, at 3 rep PR in training, then a 1 rep PR at the meet, you're really killing it there. Like four PRs throughout the course of the training cycle plus the meet. Other questions?
So kind of along the same lines, I'm not new to competing. I was a Division I baseball player. Consider myself intermediate, but at this point,
humble brag.
Powerlifting. Say it again.
Definite humble brag.
Average at best. But I'm new to powerlifting in the sense of competing. Uh-huh. Would you recommend getting a year or two of a base of training first, or would you, you know, kind of get your feet wet and operate?
Yeah, I think you can definitely just jump in and do the meet. I see a lot of times, and not saying that you're doing this necessarily, but a lot of times people are like, well, I want to be this strong before I do the meet. When they start doing that, the numbers of how strong they want to be before they do the meet consistently go up. They get close to those numbers, just a little bit stronger, just a little bit stronger before I do it. And then they end up like never competing. So I think it creates some level of urgency and just a more finite kind of goal to say, this, I'm going to do the meet, you're going to go to that meet, and you're not going to try and make, you know, all these lifetime PRs. You need to go to that first meet and pick smart weights, you know, understand sort of the process of the meet and how it works, the rules. You're probably going to miss a lift on, you know, jumping a command or whatever, and just get that out of the way. Get those first meet jitters and everything out of the way. So I'd just pick one and do it and then go from there.
Yeah.
Last question.
That's my problem. I kind of go along with that. Is I want to compete and do a meet really badly, but at the same time, I played football for 15 years, so I have such a competitive mindset that I want to place, and I know if I don't place, it's going to crush me. So it goes along with what you said. You know, people go in and they want to have this, you know, total PR for that before they go into the meet. That's kind of my issue too. What would you recommend that I just do it anyway?
Yeah. What would happen if you went and did terrible? I mean, what's gonna happen? Okay, but like after you throw a temper tantrum and you go, you know, you throw your belt at the wall and, you know, huff out. What's gonna happen? Like, you're gonna train again and go to the next one.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
I started doing jiu-jitsu in August. Throughout my competitive life, I was a 2-time collegiate national champion in the shot put. I started doing powerlifting, I told 1962 at my first meet. I squatted 800 pounds. My second meet was 2165, was the number 2 total in the world at 308s. My third meet, I squatted 905 for American record. Then I started doing strongman. My 4th strongman contest, I've been doing it for 9 months, I turned pro. Several humble brags. I started doing jiu-jitsu in August. I did my first tournament 5 weeks ago. I got beat twice by people who I looked at before, and I was like, I'm going to kick this guy's ass. Yeah. And I got beat twice. I went 0-2. There has never been anything in my life that I lost once at the start of it, let alone twice at. I'm going to go do another one in June.
I've been to that before.
Yeah. And it for sure sucks when it happens. I've now told like 10,000% more people that I lost both matches. I've just been hiding it away and hoping that no one would ever ask. But yeah, you just kind of got to get it out of the way and see, well, this is where I need to improve, and this is what I did well, and you can just move forward from there. Yeah.
Something to remember too about, like, it's a sport. And being a guy who can go in the gym and squat, bench press, and deadlift more than the world records doesn't mean shit. And there's many, many, many strong men I've met that are the king of the gym, and they were the shits on the platform, and they just got their asses kicked all the time. So the sooner you get into meets, the sooner you start doing it, the more you become an actual competitor and learn the sport itself versus just mimicking it in the gym, right?
All right, so that was the Jug Life podcast. Upcoming events we have Friday the 13th in Oakland, California at Max's Gym. We'll have another Jug Life Live, which hopefully, did you guys enjoy this today? Yeah. With the cheering.
There you go.
All right, so you should come to that at Max's Gym. You can sign up at store.jtsstrength.com under the events section. We will be back in Long Island August 19th. For the 2018 Juggernaut Performance Summit. That is Max talking about developing weightlifting technique. I'll be talking about powerlifting programming. Dr. Mike Isratel on nutrition, James Hoffman on recovery, and Quinn Henock talking all Quinn movement mobility type of stuff. It's a very information-packed one-day event. Sunday, August 19th at the Long Island Marriott in Uniondale. Last time we were there was last January 2017. There were attendees from 22 different states, including people who flew from Vancouver, Canada, and Nevada, America, all the way over here. So considering all of you live pretty close to here, I'm assuming, you guys should make it here, and you on the internet should also make it there, because it's about as, you know, we cover kind of the five main areas of training all in one day. Plus, if you need them, NSCA CEUs are available. Beyond that, if you're interested in online coaching, we offer coaching for powerlifting, weightlifting, super total, power building, and strongman through juggernautcoaching.com. Subscribe to our YouTube channel where we release 3 videos per week. Thank you to the world's strongest videographer, Shorty Sedang. And now that he's 127. Maybe not pound for pound anymore. And if you like the Jug Life podcast, go on iTunes, give us a 5-star review. We always appreciate that. Where's my review? Nope, I forgot to write one down. But if you like it, go give us a 5-star review on iTunes, and we'll send you something funny or... No, you write something funny or nice.
Or you might get something funny. Who knows?
Maybe. And maybe I'll read it on the air if I remember to take a screenshot of one before the episode. Max, where can they find you?
You can find me on Instagram, Max_Ada on Facebook, or you can email me, max@jtsstrength.com.
And I'm Chad Wesley Smith, @ChadWesleySmith and @JuggernautTrain on Facebook and Instagram. Thank you to Outlift Athletics for hosting us today, and we'll see you next week.
All right.